Hey, good evening, and welcome to the Gin and Tonic Show on this special, unusual Tuesday, the 16th of January, 2018. We are doing a special version or an unusual version of the Gin and Tonic Show this evening. I have two guests with me tonight. It is Abdullah Samir and Abdullah Gondol. Both are ex-Muslims. They have agreed to join us this evening. Abdullah Samir is over in the US side of the equation, and Abdullah Gondol, I'm actually not sure. He may have said to me where he is, but I'm not sure. But this was one of the few times that we could get the two of them together, and I thought that would be a great opportunity to have two ex-Muslims on here to discuss a couple of topics. What we're going to look to discuss initially is some of the, shall we say, fun around the Speaker's Corner group that has happened recently. So for those who are not aware, there's a few groups on Facebook. And so both Abdullahs were on that group and subsequently banned from the group. So we'll chat a little bit about that. We'll also talk about the Surah Like It. And then we'll talk about something that I'm not as familiar with, but both Abdullahs can tell me more, which is a gentleman by the name of Kenny, or a Muslim by the name of Kenny. So we'll talk more about that. To make it easier for the viewers and for myself, both Abdullahs have agreed that I can just refer to them by their surnames. So I will refer to Samir and Gondol, and that way we'll know who we're talking about, and they'll know who we're talking about. So good evening, guys. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, it's a pleasure having me here. It's Abdullah Gondol here. I'm a Pakistani ex-Muslim. I was Muslim, born and raised in the last 2 years before I left Islam. I was an imam, giving khutbahs, leading salah in the local community. I'm from Canada, just letting you guys know. And I'll hand it over to Abdullah Samir to introduce himself now.
Hi there. So like Abdullah Gondol was saying, I'm also in Canada, not US. But yeah, we're in different parts of Canada. So we haven't actually physically met. I hope to meet you one day, Abdullah Gondol. And yeah, we'll just make it easier. Let's go by Samir. That'll just make things easier.
So can you guys share, I mean, obviously, Gondol, you went through a very brief thing there that, you know, you were an imam before and you used to, when you, I missed that last word because you're not as clear. So you used to, when I use the word preach, but it wasn't strictly preaching, or was it?
Not only did I used to preach, I have the honor of converting two people to Islam. I used to lead the prayer in the local mosque. I would give sermons on Fridays, and this went on for about a good 2 years. And then eventually started having doubts about my faith, and I left Islam. It was quite shocking for the community because I was so intertwined with them and I was so active. There's a whole 2-hour interview that Samir did with me. It goes into much more detail about my story and where I come from, what it's all about.
Okay, so after the show, if you can give us a link, I'll post a link, or if you've got a link that you can send me into the internal chat here, if you can see it on your phone. If not, we'll do it afterwards, but it'd be good to post that in the chat for people who are interested in that, because obviously that will be an expanded version of what you've gone through here. So before we get to Samir, can you just tell me what was the reason or a couple of the main reasons why you started to doubt it and then eventually left? So that's for Gondol, sorry.
Oh, okay. So I started reading more about the Quran, more criticisms of Islam, right? And eventually I started noticing that it's the same as any other religion. It makes the same absolute truth claims. It makes the same miracle claims. It has a book like other religions. But there is no evidence for any of those claims, right? So I was like, well, how do I verify or distinguish between Islam, Christianity, or Judaism, or any other religion for the matter? Because if there's no evidence, what do I believe at all? A bunch of things then kept coming up, like when I started reading the Quran with the critical lens instead of the devotional lens, I started seeing that the book has quite a few very, very bad ideas. It spews out a lot of hatred towards non-believers. It has some very misogynistic values in it. And eventually I came to the conclusion that an infinitely wise God can can just not say any of this stuff. And he could have come up with so many better ways to communicate with us. And unfortunately, the Quran is a very underwhelming effort by him.
Okay, good. Cool. And Samir, maybe you can just briefly share yours. As I say, a few people might have heard it, but for those who haven't, maybe you can share the same sort of story and why you changed and what were the reasons for you, for your sort of deconversion.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So for me, it started off with an innocuous Facebook comment. And someone mentioned something about how the stories in the Quran actually originated from Jewish myths. And being the sincere, devoted believer that I was, I said, okay, you know what? Let me look into this, because you know what? I'm going to help you to understand that these stories are actually from God and they're actually true stories. The Quran says over and over again that, you know, it tells Mary that you were not there when we, you know, when we pick lots, when they pick lots to decide, you know, who's going to take care of Maryam. And, you know, I'm Allah, I'm telling you, Muhammad, that this is what happened. You weren't there, you don't know. So I'm like, yeah, these are true stories. And so this kind of initiated the whole thing. I mean, to begin with, in the first place, I actually, in a sense, converted to Orthodox Sunnism. I was born as an Ismaili, and Ismailis don't, you know, they're very different. So I converted to Sunnism in around the age of 18 or so. And so, in a sense, everything was new to me, and I was very sincere. I believed it really sincerely. I felt that this is the truth from God. And then when this came up to me, this wasn't maybe not the first time I heard it, but I truly believed I could convince him that this information he had was incorrect. And when I started looking into it, I started to see that it, you know, the tale was a winding tale, and the stories were winding stories that started with the rabbis, you know, telling them and retelling them and retelling them in the Talmud. And these stories conveniently ended up in the Quran, right? So I was like a little bit disturbed by that. And that's what opened up the door for me to look into it more and more. And then Alexander the Great, you know, Dhul Qarnayn, that was a major issue. And then, you know, the whole perspective of how Allah describes the universe, it's very 7th century, it's very flawed. So that's how I got to where I am now. I was able to confront my cognitive dissonance, because it started with a little bit of, you know, questioning, and then it got deeper. As I got deeper and deeper, I realized that there's no good reason to believe this book is from God. Like, it's just like, there's no reason to believe it. And so I was left with a few kind of shaky linguistic miracle claims, because everything else that I thought was true, I found out to be false. And so at that point, I'm like, well, I guess this is not the book. This book's not actually from God, right? It doesn't have anything to. There's no substance behind this claim.
Okay, no, fair enough. What is it for you? Because I was speaking to somebody today, actually, on a hangout that is a Muslim, still is, and at one point he was questioning, but he's now sort of gone back to more of that sort of, I wouldn't say dogmatic, but more of a case of, well, if science or the natural world can't explain it, then God is a good explanation. I'll just take that. And how come you, either of you, didn't sort of go that route?
Gondal, you would go first.
Okay. Well, that's the classic God of the gaps fallacy. It's cashing on our ignorance and our lack of understanding, and just basically fits God into the equation. It's like, hey, I don't know where the sun goes or why does it set or rise. Hence, God does it. Or like the Quran beautifully puts it, why do birds fly? Because God holds them in the air. Or why does the sky not fall on you? Oh, because God has invisible pillars holding it up, right? So it's the God of the gaps fallacy. Abdullah, over to you.
But why didn't you, Gondal, or you, Samir, why didn't you guys sort of stay with that? Because it seems like it's a safety net. So what was it for the two of you that made you kind of go, well, I'm going to move away from that safety net, whether you believe that or not. But what sort of pushed you, as I can see this particular Muslim I spoke to today, he's like, no, I want to believe this, and I'm going to believe it unless you can give me overwhelming evidence that it's not the case.
So in my case, I had already demonstrated once in my life that I was willing to give up my beliefs and change them when evidence came to me, you know, otherwise. So when I converted from Ismailism to Sunnism, At that point, I was acknowledging that, you know what I was believing in was incorrect, and what I believe in now is correct. That's what I believed, right? And so I already had a sort of commitment to the truth as I believed in it or as I saw it. And so when the information that was available to me changed, and I think the biggest thing that was holding me back was scientific illiteracy. I didn't understand a lot of science. I had a very rudimentary understanding of, I didn't have any understanding of human evolution. I didn't have any understanding of human biology. I didn't have any understanding of any of cosmology. And when I started to learn, you know, because I was a kind of curious guy, and I wasn't that dogmatic that I would close my mind to like reading other books and stuff. And so, you know, being in a world where you're exposed to a lot of things, you know, you have friends at work that might not actually be believers, and they might question you and say, well, what about this? What about that? And so the holes, the cognitive dissonance started to build. And like, it got to the point where, like, it wasn't like a long time for me. It was just like, you know, because I was constantly like researching and looking into things and reading. As soon as I started to see the holes, like, it wasn't like I carried that burden with me like some people do for years and years. I just looked into it right away. And then actually, in a sense, I did kind of carry it with me because I just blocked it from my mind for one full year after that. But for the most part, like when it became an active situation and I was looking into it, then I was able to like spend time and get to the bottom of it. And just, you know, I got to the bottom of it, in my opinion, and I decided that it just doesn't make sense to believe in this anymore. So I guess from my perspective, it's a commitment to following what I believe to be true, not going with, you know, what feels right or what I want to be true or what, you know what I mean? So it's all about like what makes sense and is coherent, and like, you know, all the pieces fit in well together. Now more than ever before, like as a believer, you have to hold a lot of contradictory things in your mind. And you gotta, like, because there's people that are much smarter than me, and I always wonder that. I'm like, how is it that these people that are biologists and these people that are geologists and these people that are much, much more intelligent than me, and they understand the Big Bang much better than I ever could, and they still believe in this book? And I used to say, well, I'm a nobody. How come I, like, what's different about me than anybody else? And I realized that a lot of people are able to carry the cognitive dissonance. They just compartmentalize the two things in the mind, and they say, this is my belief and this is my worldly matter. So you have people that are like pharmacists that understand at a very, you know, like very practical level how evolution works, because, you know, there's you're giving out antibiotics and stuff, and you understand that, you know, like bacteria can evolve and this and that. But at the same time, they believe that God made Adam and Eve, which goes against, you know, genetic, you know, what we understand about genetics and the human genome and all that. And so I guess I wasn't able to keep those two kind of things compartmentalized. To me, it was just one big box. Reality included belief in God and science, and everything was, in my mind, was consistent. And I didn't want to have two different beliefs at the same time like that. So I was able to kind of, because the way I see the world is a little bit different, or maybe because I'm willing to admit that I was wrong. I don't know, some personality characteristic allowed me to become free from this religion.
Mm, good. And Gondal, for yourself, what do you think made the difference for you, that perhaps other Muslims in your position might have also voiced their, you know, maybe have thought about it, but then stayed Muslim? What was it for you that pushed you away and didn't allow you to sit back and stay in the comfort zone, so to speak?
It was mostly being questioned over and over again by some fellow coworkers that are non-believers. And when I started looking into I actually started trying to answer their questions, and I started researching. When I looked into Islam, I just kept finding a hole after a hole after a hole. It's like it's a bucket with a bunch of holes in it, and the more water you pour in, the more it leaks. I just took the basic claim, like, is the Quran perfectly preserved? It wasn't. Does the Quran have scientific blunders? Yes, it does. What does the Quran reflect? It reflects the 7th century understanding of the world from a 7th century Arab. And eventually I just came to the conclusion that I can't lie to myself. I just cannot. I cannot hold contradictory beliefs when I can see that there's overwhelming evidence for, suppose, evolution, and there's no evidence for Adam and Eve. I was like, I just can't go on with this. So eventually, it was just about being intellectually honest to myself, and that's it.
Okay, great. I want to ask both of you, because this is a charge that's made against many ex-Muslims that I hear, and certainly on your point, Gondal, if you could speak on it first. One of the claims that potentially would be made to you as well, you just didn't go and speak to scholars and other Islamic experts. You took it upon yourself, and you know, you're not knowledgeable enough to make the decision to become an ex-Muslim. So what would be your response to that? And then obviously, Samir, if you could do the same. In other words, why did you guys not go and consult the scholars? Because Muslims have got answers to all of these questions. It's maybe that you just didn't go and look hard enough for them.
For me, I actually did consult scholars. I did go looking. I actually researched for a whole year. And it's not like I wasn't a really knowledgeable Muslim either. Like, I was giving sermons. I had people convert to Islam. So I had a very good idea. The answers that I unfortunately got from the scholars were very unsatisfactory. And most of them were like, oh, just wait and inshallah, you'll find out. And the justifications were more ad hoc rationalizations, didn't add up. They would contradict themselves at points. At the end, one thing I note about this allegation made against ex-Muslims is when Muslims look at other faiths, they don't consult their scholars that much, or they don't do a PhD in that religion before rejecting it as false. So why would you require the same thing from a Muslim? It doesn't add up. Like, you can become a Muslim by knowing absolutely nothing about Islam, but if you have to leave it, you're apparently supposed to have a PhD in Islamic studies and have 30 years of teaching experience. Like, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I do see a bit of a disconnect with newly converted Muslims, because I don't get a chance to speak to them, unfortunately, but I would want to understand what their reasons are, especially for the newly converted ones. You're probably right. There may well be a few that have really studied for years and could come back and give you all kinds of good reasons. And when I listen to a few of them, my sense is that they don't know very much, but the little they've heard seems to make sense. Maybe I've heard from a few people that, hey, I was in prison and this helped me out. So there's a utility value in it rather than a truth value. And so sometimes it plugs a hole, they have a community, et cetera, et cetera. And those are the reasons, which are not necessarily good reasons for believing something. It's good reasons to fill up your life necessarily, but it's not necessarily means that it's true. Maybe you could speak on that, Samir, as well.
Yeah, so for me, I did actually. So when I first started having doubts, I talked to my wife about it, and she recommended, I talk to my friends, get someone more knowledgeable to answer my questions. So that's what I did. I spoke with one of the Al Maghrib Institute teachers. I had a private meeting with one of my friends, organized a private meeting one-on-one with a sheikh at a mosque. And so just to give you an interesting, tidbit, the Al Maghrib sheikh was, Salafi. The sheikh at the mosque was Sufi. So like those different people I was talking to, it wasn't just like one, interpretation, because I told myself maybe the doubts I'm having, maybe the issues I'm finding, I just need to look at it from a different perspective. So, maybe I need to reinterpret how I've been taking the Quran, right? And I was quite excited when I went to talk to the Sufi, because I wasn't off that, mindset. And I'm like, well, maybe he has a different way of looking at things, and maybe he can prove to me something that I never thought of. And of course, I went to meet a bunch of my friends. One of them is a teacher at a mosque. And another one, he teaches at a university in the US. He teaches Islam at a university. And I talked to them. Most of these people, I talked for hours and hours. The interesting thing is most of the scholars, they're not really able to deal with issues like this. Because they don't study these things. Like when you go to Islamic Institute of Medina or Mecca, or if you go to like Hamza Yusuf Mauritania and you're studying in the desert with some sheikh, you're studying the intricate issues of wudu, like you're learning about, you know, how to wash yourself and five times or three times, and you have to do this and you have to do that. And then you're studying about the scholars and, you know, this and that, and you're studying about how Muhammad did this. And you don't even look into like the issues in the Quran. Like you're not challenged like that, right? You don't know that, you know, the embryology in the Quran is a direct ripoff of Greek, you know, Galenic medicine, right? You don't know that the Surah Kaf, you know, mirrors the Alexander the Great, the Syriac version. You don't know that the story of Jesus, you know, talking as a baby was also found in another document that was available in the Syriac language in a place near Arabia, which is called the Infancy Gospel, right? Like, so you don't know these things. So when you talk to scholars, they're just dumbfounded. Like, they don't know anything. They're like, oh, like what? Like, so they don't have any answers to that. But when you talk to like when I talked to my friends, the best conversation I had was I went to my friend's house. He told me he almost became atheist and he became Muslim again. And that guy, despite not being a scholar, that 5-hour conversation I had at his house was much more helpful than any scholar I could talk to. Because he went through this, right? Like he went through this hell, as he put it, you know, like doubting and not, and he never told anybody that he was having doubts, and he just was having a lot of doubts about Islam. And at the end of it, the conclusion he came up with was Pascal's wager. Like, and I was just disappointed with that. Like that was, to me, that's not enough. You know, saying that, you know what, yes, there's some issues in Islam, and he said, I'm willing to let those things go, you know, just in case, basically, you know, I want to be on the safe side of God, kind of like that. And to me, that was a very, I'm not going to live my life just in case Allah is true. No, absolutely not. Like, that's not how you should live your life. You live your life with certainty in what makes sense to you, you know, what your noggin is telling you, the brain that God gave us, if you believe in God, or the brain that evolved, you know, like what makes sense to you. And that's what we'll be held accountable to if you believe that there's a God that's going to hold us to account. It's not, you don't want to live with insincerity, or you don't want to live just in case out of fear. You know, that's not the life that I wanted to live anyway. So after this 5-hour conversation, and the funny thing is, the issues I brought up with him, some of them were very petty issues. Like right now, after being like leaving Islam and being an ex-Muslim for almost 2 years now, I have much stronger arguments against Islam than that time when I was just wondering about here, this little thing here, this little thing there. You know, when you first leave Islam, sorry, I'm going on and on, but I'll end with this. When you leave Islam, you're like, oh, I have some doubts in Islam. I have some doubts in the Quran. You know, there's this problem I found in the Quran. But like, when you look into it more, you're like, why should I believe in the Quran? Like your whole perspective changes. Like you figure out the burden of proof is not on you to prove the Quran is wrong, but it's on the Quran to prove that it's correct in the first place, right? So once that perspective changes, now you're asking, well, why should I believe in it? Like, what reason do I have, right? And then the whole paradigm is different. But at that point, you know, I did my best to look into it, and I did talk to it. But you know, you can never talk to enough sheikhs. Like even if you talk to like 5 sheikhs, they'll say talk to 6. Like if you talk to 6, talk to 7. Like they'll never be happy because, and the sad thing is, you find this. I found this more in the Desi, like the Indian and the Pakistani and the Bangladeshi community. They're more about, and the Sufi community, they're more about outsourcing the thinking to the scholars. So they won't actually think for themselves. If you tell them, well, what about this? They'll say, oh, talk to a sheikh, right? Talk to Maulana. Maulana Saab will have an answer for you. And so they've outsourced the thinking. And at that point, there's nothing you can do to help them because they're no longer depending on their own intellect. They've just been like, they just said, okay, I'm done thinking. I'm just not going to think about it. I'm just going to follow blindly. And at that point, there's nothing you can do.
Yeah, that's true. Brilliant. Gondal, maybe you can speak on the issue, kind of on the issue that Samir brought up there, which is sometimes the response. Sometimes when I'm talking in Speaker's Corner, they will refer to the sheikhs on one hand, but on the other, they're saying that this is a book for all people for all times. Now, the claim that I've heard is that, hey, some verses are clear and some are ambiguous. And my response is, well, if God is supposed to be sending us a very clear message, assuming A, that he exists, B, that he wants us to know that he exists, and C, that he's going to, then he should be able to send us a clear message. And if there's ambiguities there, how do we deal with that? So could you share a thought, and then we'll move into some of the topics that we talked about, you know, we discussed prior to starting. Could you give me your thoughts on the, seeming to me anyway, somewhat of a paradox between, hey, you've got to consult the sheikhs, but at the same time, this is a book for everybody for all time.
Yeah. So one of the issues with Islam is that it's different from other religion is the grand claim that the Quran is not just a book of God, it's actually the literal speech of God. And then this puts Muslims in a more defensive mindset, because the literal speech of God can have zero issues with it. Whereas if you look at the Bible, it's inspired word of God written by men. So they're okay with justifying, oh, there's some verses that make sense, some don't. The other issue is with the Quran is it claims that it's the eternal, final, ever communication of God to mankind. And it's the message till the day of judgment. The problem is half of the Quran you can't even understand without the hadith. And what makes it worse is the Quran itself keeps claiming to say that this is a clear book, this is a precise book, this is a kitab mubin. But half the book it doesn't even make sense. Like, you cannot understand it without contextual hadith or supporting literature. Then the issue occurs is, like, suppose if you bring up some issues like why Muhammad married his daughter-in-law, or why does Samala polygamy, or sex slavery, or slavery in general, Muslims will come up with the answer that, oh, it was just for that specific time period. But I'm like, well, that goes against the whole idea of this being an eternal message for all mankind till the end of time. So again, there are just so many contradictions within the Islamic framework itself that it doesn't make sense to me.
Yes, I think that's one of the points that I sort of talked about, which is if Muslims came up the idea that this is a book for all time, for all people, and that Muhammad is a great example, or perfect example, in some people say, to follow for all time, then we wouldn't be having as many of these discussions. We'd be going, okay, he was a person that lived at that time. He may have made it in some way better than what it was prior to him being there. That's open for debate, of course. And the book may have given people some additional morals and some additional thoughts and directions that they didn't have prior to Islam coming about. That could be argued, not a problem. And the moment if you kept it as that, we wouldn't be having as many conversations. We'd still go, okay, by today's standard, that's not a great way to live. You don't know very much about the world, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact that they are importing it into today's world, and particularly the sort of collision with Western modernity and so forth, seems to me, whenever I speak to people in Speaker's Corner or online or when I watch other people, there's this challenge with trying to get the book of 1400 years ago to fit to today. And so whenever people quote scholars, I'm very apprehensive with Islamic scholars, because they're not there to look critically at it. They're there to make it fit today. And I think that's the challenge I have with anything that an imam or a sheikh would say that is trying to get the Quran to match modern day morality or science or whatever the case is. Whereas I'd rather have an independent Western scholar look at it and do textual criticism, as the Christians would say, and really look at it much more in depth and go, hang on a moment, here's a problem. But I don't notice the scholars doing that, or if they do, I've never heard of them. What's your thoughts, Samir?
Yeah, absolutely. We don't find that that's something that's kind of acceptable in the Islamic tradition. So, you know, so much so that you have people like Noman Ali Khan saying that people that study Islam in a Western institution, they end up leaving Islam. And he's like, they've taken apart Islam like you can't imagine. I had a friend, he went to Harvard and he was studying Islam. And he came back and he like left Islam. And he's like, don't study Islam at a Western university. Like, you know, go to your sheikh or go to your country or whatever, but don't study here, because they'll take it apart and they'll put doubts in your mind like you can't imagine. And so, you know, yeah, Muslim scholars, you're right, they have one job and one job alone, and that's to avoid doubt. Like I was saying, they don't study those things. And not just don't study those things, the things that they do study, that they know are problems in Islam, they don't raise those issues. They're explicitly taught, do not talk about this. For example, the whole thing between, you know, when Muhammad died, when Abu Bakr and, you know, was having a conflict with Ali, and the whole thing about how Aisha fought Ali and there was a big battle and, you know, Muslims were killed on both sides. And, you know, like things like that, you're taught as a Muslim scholar. We don't talk about these things. You know, when it comes to the whole free will and predestination debate in Islam, they're like, no, 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 we don't talk about this because it's confusing and it confuses people. So we don't, you know, and so like, I think it's very intentional, right? Like there's certain topics when you look them up on Islamic websites, they're like glaringly absent, right? And nobody talks about these things because it causes fitna, right, in the community. It causes doubt. It causes dissension, right? So nobody wants to talk about it. Yes, Shias are happy to talk about it. Shias love to talk about how terrible Abu Bakr and Aisha are. But I mean, in the Sunni community, they don't want to talk about that because it actually goes against the narrative, right? Which is to keep selling Islam to the masses. And I guess in a sense, they're doing the same thing that Christians do where they, well, the sad thing is Islam teaches that you shouldn't lie, right? At any cost, for pretty much especially for the sake of like spreading the religion, you shouldn't lie, right? Yet in a sense, that's what people do, right? Like they're very honest until it comes to this topic, and then they'll kind of like be a little bit like sneaky about, you know, not talking about certain things and avoiding certain topics. And, you know, like, you know, so yeah, I agree with you. The salesman, right? Like the salesman for the religion, and that's the job.
Yes. Okay. So I want to touch on one thing because both of you have talked about it, but I do want to bring it up because obviously it happens in Speaker's Corner and elsewhere. So talk to me, let's start with you, Gondal, and we'll come back to you, Samir. Talk to me, Gondal, about the Muslim apologetics, because clearly they're, well, certainly in Speaker's Corner, and there may well be other places, may or may not be as much in Canada, but there are sort of Muslim apologists coming out now. So there are being, some Muslims are being taught about apologetics and are being taught to try and answer some of these questions. So what's been your experience, Gondal, speaking to, if you have had conversations with people that are have learned some apologetics?
I have been interacting with a lot of Muslim apologists on Facebook over the past few months. One thing I've noticed is most of their answers are trying really hard to rationalize insanities. And I'll give you one example, and we'll take this conversation towards the Hyde Park group. Like there's I was looking at the hadith and I found these sayings that Muhammad actually had people asked people to take his spit, his saliva, rub it on their faces and on their bodies, and then mix it with his ablution water and then drink it. And then he would have people take his sweat and rub it on their bodies as perfume, right? So like the response to these kind of issues is sad and at the same time funny. A lot of these Muslim apologists would come up with rationalizations and like, oh, since he's the prophet of God, God put blessing and healing in his saliva, hence it's okay for us to do it. But I'm like, why would an infinitely wise God make his prophet so indistinguishable from 100 other fake prophets that claim to do the same? That feed people their bodily fluids and whatnot, right? And these are all post-fact rationalizations. And this one quote comes to my mind from Amy Scobie, who's an ex-Scientologist executive. She said, I had a blinding realization. What I'm doing is I'm rationalizing insanities. And after that, she left Scientology. A lot of Muslim apologetics aren't trying to make sense to normal people. They're trying to make it sound more reasonable to the gullible believers that are already believing in this stuff. They'll try the most ridiculous straw man ideas and then make them sound a little acceptable. And from one, the believer's perspective, it might sound reasonable, but from a neutral lens, it'll still sound absurd. And most of them do the same thing. It's just sugarcoating the Quran. Or like one example I'll give you is the allegation about Surah 4, verse 34, where the Quran literally tells their husbands to beat their wives if they fear disobedience, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the Muslim apologetics for quite a while have brought this thing that, oh, it just says to hit them lightly or tap them with a piece of stick or tickle them with a feather mm-hmm. or a handkerchief, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when you analyze the claim, it's like you fear disobedience, so God says you have to admonish your wife and, you know, scold her. If she still doesn't listen, you separate from her in bed. Now, these are some serious measures, and this is in terms of your wife doing something really rebellious, right? Yeah. But then suddenly you're told, but yeah, but if all of that fails, you go to your wife and then tap her lightly on the shoulder with a pen or throw a handkerchief at her, and that will suddenly just make her understand, oh, I shouldn't be rebellious, right? So you come up with these kind of explanations, and to believers, it makes sense. Because they're so hard trying in their minds to make sense out of it. But to neutral people, it doesn't.
Yes, and I think that's you've touched on a good point, which is especially, and stop spamming my co-host on the Genotonic often says that most believers are better than their book, I think is the way he often puts it. And I think, you know, when you're brought up and you start to think a little bit, you do go, hang on a moment, how do I get around this? And then somebody gives you an explanation, you go, "Ooh, okay, that's what it means. And the scholar said it, and therefore, you know, that sounds like it must be true." And most Muslims will never go look into this themselves. They will accept whatever a scholar says, if there is a scholar that's saying that. So Sabia, if we can sort of, you can obviously add a little bit to that. I think your view of apologetics, because you've had quite a bit as well. But before you do that, the one thing that you did say, Gondal, that I wrote down here is, and this is what I notice in Speaker's Corner, is that they do appear to argue, if you want to use that term, and their intention is to keep, and it's not meant derogatory, it's just my observation, the gullible and credulous Muslims in the fold, because most of them don't know how to argue properly. They're not going to go look up things. And if it sounds even half okay, they will go, that's okay. And when I see a lot of viewers commenting on Speaker's Corner videos, for example, they're more interested in the debates, the almost like the battle of the debate, and who won and who lost from a point of view of somebody said more, they sounded like they knew more. It's not a case of let me go and investigate who said what is more, and which is more likely true. So maybe Samir, maybe you can share a few thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think you made a very good point that I think in a sense, we can talk about this when we get to the topic of debate as well. I think in a sense, many Muslims know deep down that there's some big assholes in the religion. And so in the back of their mind, they know that you can't prove these things. They know that you can't justify these things, that the justification is weak. So they're looking for someone to just make them feel better, because they want to maintain status quo. And to maintain status quo, you have these people coming along and kind of smoothing out the bumps for them, right? Like Noman Ali Khan, he has this video about beating women. And I first watched it, I couldn't believe what he was saying. Like, he came up with the most strangest things he was like saying, right? And I was like, and like things I've never heard of before, like, you know, when he's talking about, you know, when you feel your wife, you know, being rebellious, he said, oh, that means she cheated on you. But then in another verse in the Quran, it says if your wife commits zina, you know, you're supposed to whip her 40 times or the judge or whatever, right? So it's like, it's inconsistent. And it's like a very strange thing. Like it was completely like when I saw that video, I couldn't believe what he was saying. And it was so illogical. And it made no sense to me. And I was like, this is just nonsense. Like, he's just making videos to make people feel better about themselves, to make them feel better about. And the funny thing is, people will fall, you know, will watch this video and they don't even realize like how silly these arguments are. They're not even consistent, right? I mean, the good thing was in the video, he did say that he doesn't take the approach of hit being like, you know, tap or whatever. He said hit is hit, but then he was actually justifying it. He was actually saying it's okay to hit. right? If your wife cheats on you and this and that. I mean, no word about what happens if the husband cheats on the wife. Mm. It's just like, you know, it's all about the husband, what he gets to do to her, right? And it's all about controlling women. And so my kind of, you know, what I've seen about apologetics is, I guess I haven't been that, like, haven't been exposed to it that much, but the times I do say it, I see it, I shake my head sometimes and I'm like, you know, I need to make a response video to this, like, and then I haven't got to, you know, I haven't managed to do everything that I wanted to do, because it takes a lot of effort to make response videos, and sometimes I just feel like, oh, this is too much work. But yeah, it's to make people feel better, right? With the choices they've already made, and they don't want to rock the boat. They don't want to, you know, challenge the status quo. They don't even want to discuss it. They don't want to think about it. They're just like, yeah, that's what I believe in. That's it, right?
Yes. Okay, good. So let's transition, because it does kind of transition a little bit into the Hyde Park Speakers Corner group on Facebook. The admin may be joining us. I've sent him a link. He's on his way back. Hopefully he can join us this evening if he gets back in time. But Gondal, start with yourself. Let us know sort of a little bit of the timeline you joined. What did you kind of do? And then what subsequently happened? And then Samir can actually use as well.
So basically, I've been following Speakers Corner videos online on YouTube from like Ali Dava, Muhammad Hijab, and a couple of Christian guys and atheist guys. They go to this park and they argue. So I got in contact with you and you told that there's a Facebook group. So I got added into it alongside Abdullah Samir. So when I got in there, I noticed that there's an overwhelming domination, or the majority of the members are Muslims. And not only that, the one other thing I noticed is all the moderators and admins are all Muslims. There's not a single non-believer in there, which was weird. So anyways, I made a post about the Muhammad asking people to, you know, rub his spit on their faces and drink his saliva. And all I did was I just showed the references with screenshots from their holy books, right? And then they started rationalizing it and saying that they would. Yeah.
Just want to ask something. Was it that he was asking them to do that, or was it like they just did that on their own, like taking his wudu water and drinking it, and taking his saliva and taking his you know, like his aunt taking his sweat when he was sleeping? Was that something he commanded them to do, or was that just something they just did out of like fervor, religious fervor, and like actually, kind of what you'd call extremism or fanaticism, almost, or almost like idol worship, right?
Yeah, no, at actually certain points, he was actually commanding them to do it, to the point where he asked, I think, Bilal and Abu Musa about rubbing his spit on their bodies and faces and chest to accept the glad tidings, because two other guys rejected it and they accepted, they mix it with water, they drink it, and then Muhammad's wife is sitting behind the curtain. She's like, oh, please leave some of the ablution water mixed with the saliva for me as well. So they gave it to her and she drank it too. It wasn't just out of fervor. Like, he was actually commanding them to do it too. Anyways, I posted this and it was nothing wrong about the post. It was just showing Islamic literature written by Muslims, translated by Muslims with all the references. And people started rationalizing it, right? And I'm like, okay, so these people are saying they're going to rub his spit if they could, if they had pimples on their face, they'll drink his ablution water mixed with his spit. And then they started comparing this kind of fanatic love for a religious leader with sexual intimacy with a spouse or a partner, which is a false equivalence on many levels. And then suddenly my post got deleted. And I was like, I didn't do anything wrong. I just showed you what Muhammad and his followers were doing from your own books. And I guess it made Islam look really bad, because it appears to be a very culty thing to do. Eventually.
So just going to ask you something, Gondal, at this point. Any of your comments, I mean, if you look back and if you were sort of honest and if you put yourself into a Muslim's shoes for a moment, were there any of your comments that you think could have been conceivably construed as being offensive or whatever the case is? I'm just interested in whether you can look back and see whether that could have been the case if you were, you know, I would say a slightly touchy Muslim, for want of a better word. Is there anything in there? Because obviously if we do get the admin on, he will have a potentially different perspective. So I just want to see, obviously, I want to see if we can get two sides to every story. And so I just want to see whether you can realize if there was something that you could have said, okay, well, here's how I could see that maybe they would think X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, the issue was like in that group, I noticed that there is no real representation or any open criticism of Islam going on. So when me and Abdullah Samir joined, we started posting very blunt questions, very to the point stuff. We weren't using any offensive language per se. We weren't attacking any Muslims. We weren't resolving ad hominems or any sort of personal attack. We were just criticizing Islam and Muhammad. And for some, as I know, like Muslims love Muhammad more than themselves and their families and their wives and their parents even. But I mean, if you want to have an honest discussion, you have to put your emotional attachments aside sometimes, because you can love Muhammad, doesn't mean I love him the same way. If he did something bad, I call it out. I'm not attacking Muslims, I'm just criticizing his actions and what he said or did. Some Muslims can't handle it, and they do get, they take the any criticism of Muhammad or Islam as a personal attack because it's their religion, which I don't seem to get, because that puts them in a spot where they're asking for a sort of immunity from criticism, or demanding that it's a right that we have to be very, very toned down in our criticism of Islam. Even though, on the other hand, when Allah is criticizing non-believers, he calls us pigs, he calls us swines, dogs, donkeys, worse than cows, worse than animals, and sometimes the worst creation ever. And I'm like, we are nowhere close to that offensiveness. We're not attacking any person. If the Quran is not considered...
Well, we are attacking a person. We're attacking the Prophet.
I just want to ask you on this point, when you did this, because obviously other people will have a different view on this, but when you quote attack the Prophet, or when you criticize the Prophet or critique the Prophet, mm-hmm. you use words that non-Muslims could conceivably find as offensive. In other words, did you say he's a pedophile, he's a rapist, he's this, that, and the other, or did you just say, hey, this is what he did, what do you think, or how did you phrase it? Because I didn't get to see all of those comments, obviously, and neither did most of the viewers here.
Yeah, no, I never used words like he's a pedophile or he's a racist or he's a murderer or anything. We just brought up the questions like, hey, what does this mean? How do you explain this? How do you explain that? And the thing is, right, a lot of the times there is no explanation for suppose this, the rubbing of the spit, right? So Muslims just instantly become apologetic and defensive, and they just start off as aggressive, and that just ruins the whole discussion.
Cool. I just want to welcome in TJ Singh. He's one of our regular panelists. He's over in the US as well. He's a non-believer, so he's going to come in and he might say a few words here and there, but I did say that I want to get, you know, you guys to do most of the talking. We're on every week, so it's I want to give you guys most of the time here. Great. Okay. So Samir, maybe you can share some of your thoughts and what posts maybe got you banned or whatever the case is.
So I had kind of taken a break from debating online, and somehow I ended up in this group. Somebody added me. I don't even know who added me. Somebody added me, right? Like, probably like, I get added. Was that you? Okay. Somebody added me. I'm like, oh, this is cool. And then I got pulled into some discussions, and I saw Abdullah Gondal's post, and I saw like how heated it was getting. I'm like, whoa, right? So I decided, let me jump in. This is interesting. I haven't had like a conversation with like people that are actually into this so much, right? Because the cool thing about the group is it's opt-in, right? It's a bunch of people that like the interested in debates, the interested in Islamic apologetics. They shouldn't be the type of people that have chips on the shoulder that are like just like, hey, you're insulting me. And yes, I understand you feel insulted. You should feel insulted because I'm saying your religion is bad. Yeah, I understand you feel upset about that. I mean, I'm upsetting you. I know I'm upsetting you, but that's the group, right? That's what Speaker's Corner is. You go to Speaker's Corner, you know there's going to be people shouting things that you don't want to hear. And I have to say, we did not say, I mean, as far as I know, you know, nobody said anything like quote unquote like vulgar or like, you know, I mean, it depends on your definition of offensive. I think people were just offended, period, about even just suggesting that there's like, just, I think, like, you know, bringing up the fact that people were drinking his spit and stuff was extremely embarrassing. And it's awkward, and it was like kind of like putting out your dirty socks or something. Some people were just, I think sometimes people react in different ways. And so anyways, I'm like, okay, that's interesting. Let me make a post as well. So I took one of my posts I made about Aisha and how she had a terrible life as being a mother of the believers, right? You know, she was married when she was young. I didn't mention the age, but I said she was a child. You know, she was playing with dolls and going on swings and whatever. And she was taken from her house and she was given to Muhammad, right? And then, but I didn't say she was like, I said she was a child, but I didn't say she was 9 or 6. I said, whatever, she's probably in her early teens. I even said early teens. Because that wasn't the point of my post, right? I mean, that horse has been beaten to death about her age, right? That wasn't my point. And I talked about how, as being one of the co-wives of 8 other women, it was a miserable life, how Muhammad would see another woman and, you know, Aisha would see, like, would notice right away, okay, this woman, she's beautiful, he's going to want to marry her, right? And how, you know, she got into constant conflict. I mean, I shouldn't say constant conflict, but she got into conflict with her co-wives, how, you know, the Prophet boycotted them. I don't even remember all the details I mentioned, but I mentioned a bunch of details. I said, and when one of the first things is, when the Prophet Muhammad died, she was a young lady in the prime of her life, and she could never get married again. And she had to be celibate for the rest of her life, right? So to me, that sucked, right? Like, if I left my wife behind, I wouldn't expect her to be celibate the rest of my life. I think that's a very selfish thing to do, to expect, you know, the woman of your life to be single just because you're extremely jealous and possessive of her. That's like ownership. That's not marriage. That's not partnership. That's like, I own you. You're my property. I don't want anyone to touch you after I'm gone, right? Like, to me, that's a very petty, insecure, jealous way of, you know, having a relationship. Anyways, I posted that. I don't know what else I posted. I posted that. People got like freaking mad at me, right? And they're like, you know, and we had a conversation. And then one guy is like, you have no basis for morality. So I made another post. I said, okay, you motivated me to make a post on atheism and morality. And then that was kind of interesting discussion. The guy was saying, you're a bunch of microbes and this and that. I'm like, yeah, whatever, fine. I'm a bunch of microbes. And then suddenly what happened? Abdullah messaged me. He's like, I got kicked out of the group. And apparently I got kicked out of the group too. So someone just kicked me out of the group. I posted about it and I'm like, what's going on here? This is like speakers corner group. This discussion, this group is made for discussion of religious topics, right? Oh, by the way, Abdullah Gondal can talk more about like the insults. I kept being called a Zionist or something, and I'm like, but I didn't even talk about Israel. Like, I didn't even mention politics. How am I a Zionist, right? Abdullah, you want to mention some things you got called, like?
Yeah, Zionist, Jewish supporter, Satan worshiper. There's people literally, I was talking about burden of proof, and this guy comes up and says, oh, you have no life, you deserve to die, go kill yourself. Like, there was comments made at this, they're still on my Facebook if you want to go, they're all screenshotted. People saying that, oh, don't even talk to him, he's worthless, he's a kafir, he's going to burn in hell. People literally cursing and praying for my demise at times. So it got very heated.
How did you respond to these people? Like, you know, calling you a dumb multad and, you know, stupid kafir or whatever. Like, did the admins do anything at this point?
The funny thing is the admins did not moderate the people who were attacking us and making the most absurd allegations against us. They're still part of that group, but we got booted. And most of the time, I wouldn't even reply to them. And if I did, I'd be like, ad hominems are useless. It just makes you look bad. There's no point of using insults, right? Let's just stick to the topic. We'll try to bring them back to the discussion, but they'll just keep attacking our person. And like, there was another post I made. This is about miracles, right? So I basically wrote that to believe in Islam, you have to believe that there's an unlettered boy, got his chest cut open, washed in a pot of gold, and he flew to heaven almost got strangled by an angel, split the moon in half, and then that the Quran propagates a bunch of fictitious stories and stuff, right? And that's the language I was using. I didn't use any derogatory remarks. I only said at the end that this is indistinguishable from the claims of Scientology or Mormonism, right? Because they both, all of them have no evidence. That post faced a lot of criticism as well, saying that, since God can do it, it's possible, so your post is irrelevant. But I'm like, well, anybody can claim God can do it, and anybody can make an uncountable number of assertions from that statement onwards. But yeah, there was just, that group was just full of hatred. It was one-sided. There was an overwhelming majority of very emotional Muslims in there. And it almost seemed like they weren't even willing to discuss in a civilized manner. But here's the catch. They would criticize Christianity, make fun of it in the group, and actually mock it worse, or use words worse than what we did. Those posts are still there. So let's just end this point. If it was only a free discussion group as long as you didn't criticize Islam.
Okay, well, yeah. If we do get the admin on, he can give us his view. I didn't see all of your posts. There was another gentleman that was booted and has since rejoined, Hassan Radovan. We actually had him on as a guest shortly on Friday. He was actually a co-founding member of the Gin and Tonic, so that was fascinating. And I was drawn to, obviously, I found you guys because you were posting your own Facebook things, and I read it, and I thought, okay, you know, you guys are making very good points here and so forth. And I saw Hassan do the same, and he got booted, but he's since come back into the group. And so apparently somebody said, you're okay, but Gondol, no, they're not going to have him. But I believe neither of you can come back. But again, we'll have, hopefully the admin will come in and share his views.
So if I can just add something. The other thing that was, to me, really disappointing, other than the fact that this is false, you know, image of openness and debate and discussion, is the fact that, you know, it's the group was not like, there was no warnings given. Like, I didn't break any rules. Like, if I did, I'd love to know, right? I'd love to know what rules I broke. It's just like all of a sudden you wake up and you're gone from the group, and it's like, huh? Somebody said something funny. He said that ex-Muslims are the kryptonite or something. So they tolerate atheists, but if you're an ex-Muslim, then you're like, you know, like, it's even, you can say the same thing as like some non-Muslim guy, but like you're an ex-Muslim and you'll be like, you know, taken more hostile. Maybe because we know the more intricate details and we can actually hold our own in the conversation, right? Whereas, you know, like if you're discussing with like, even if you're discussing with a real intellectual like Sam Harris, he may not know the details about Islam. He may not be able to respond to your claim. You might just say, oh, no, it's not part of Islam. And Sam Harris will be like, okay, I'll take your word for that. I mean, you're a Muslim, I'm not a Muslim, and that's sure, okay? But like an ex-Muslim, not that we're experts in any sense, you know, we lived the life and we have some sort of understanding above average, right? Like an above, and that's another thing with ex-Muslims. A lot of them have an above average, you know, understanding in the sense of they were more committed to the religion, in the sense of they looked into it and they researched it, and they were not everybody. Some people they didn't even look into it, and you know, they didn't look into it too much before leaving it. But there's a bunch of us, the ones that tend to be more active and more, you know, more involved in discussions. We weren't like nominal Muslims, right? Like, me and Abdullah, we believed in it like sincerely and deeply. You know, we committed a lot of time and energy to it. So, you know, when you're discussing with someone like that, you can't trick them, right? Like, they know the stuff, they're gonna like catch you when you say, oh no, Islam, not, this is not part of Islam. You'd be like, really? But the book says this, right? And when you talk to a non-Muslim that may not know all of these books, they may not know Bukhari and Muslim, they might not know about the basics of the science of hadith and tafsir, and what's the difference between tafsir and hadith, and you know, in which case can you use one over the other, and what's a weak hadith and a strong hadith, and what's an ahad chain, you know, the basic stuff that like a knowledgeable Muslim would know. A non-Muslim wouldn't know these things, so you can't really have a conversation with them about Islam to the same level. So I guess they feel a lot more threatened by it. again, like, I'm not going to force myself back into a group that doesn't want me there. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not there to, like, convince anyone in a sense. I'm there to have a conversation with whoever's interested in having a conversation. I'm really happy to have a conversation. But, like, if they don't want me in the group, I don't care. Like, I have, you know what? Like, I'm at the point where, like, I'm going to make my posts. I have certain thoughts and reflections on life, which I think people are benefiting from, and they enjoy reading, and we have this conversation. So when it comes to that, like, it's not my life mission to debunk Islam. Like, it's just my own personal reflections of what I've seen and the problems I found in it. You're free to agree or disagree. A lot of times now people will, like, respond. I'll be like, okay, you made your point. I made my point. I'm not going to debate it back and forth. I just don't have the energy level like Abdullah Gondal still has. I've been doing this for too long now. I'm just like, yeah, whatever. You don't agree with me, fine.
Yes,
also,
I guess it depends.
Just
what
to add, just to add to Abdullah, just to be fair to that group members, that there were some Muslims that actually did support our side, and I give a shout out to Sahil Ansari. He actually went to the group, made a post, and said that banning and kicking Abdullah Gondal and Abdullah Samir out was wrong. They didn't do anything wrong. It was just discussions. And he then also said that people kicking other people out just because their beliefs were allegedly offended shows that they're very insecure. And him as a Muslim saying that is a big, big thing. So I get a good shout out to him that not everybody was the same. There were some good intellectual Muslims that did engage with us in a nice way. But let's just say that the black sheep outnumber the good ones in that group.
Yes, and I think...
Yeah. One more thing. There's a lot of peer pressure put on Muslim admins to kick us out. That's what I have to say. It's like, yes, you know what? A lot of people are fine with us, but this insecurity about misleading people, it's like, it's very powerful. And they will, you know, that's going to go into the other topic. We want to talk about debates, but they will hammer the admin and they'll say, they'll guilt them. You guys are letting people become misguided. Like, how dare you? You know, you're going to be responsible on the day of judgment for everyone that leaves Islam and has doubts because of those two Abdullahs. You guys are going to be responsible for that on the day of judgment. So why are you letting these people promote the hatred of Islam, the hatred of our mother Aisha, the hatred of, you know, Allah? Why are you giving these people a platform to spout the toxic venom or whatever? Like, you know, they'll go on. And there's Muslim admins, you know, some of which live in London too, and they have to see Muslims on a daily basis in real life. They're going to feel like uncomfortable that they're going to be put on the spot, and they're like, you know, like the commitment to free speech is not going to be held up at this point when people are like, you know, confronting them, right? You know what I'm saying?
Yes. Yeah. And I think you made a good point there. And I'm going to present this, and here's an example for those who are interested. It does seem like atheism, which again, we've talked a lot about on the show. It's a single position on a single claim. It may or may not have other consequences. You've got to ask each atheist, because there are different atheists have different views. But it does seem to be something that is concerning Muslims. Here's a conference, apparently, with no atheists there, by the way, who could actually share their perspectives. But you have Hamza Tortoise and this other fella, Alhamdulillah, fella that is supposed to
have
refuted the masked Arab and various others there. I don't recognize them all. So clearly there is a concern among some Muslims about atheism. And like you said, I think you guys are the kryptonite in the sense that you're not only ex-Muslims, but you are atheist ex-Muslims. Now, if an ex-Muslim becomes a Christian, then I think the Muslims feel a little less concerned, because they can attack Christianity. They think they've got a strong case against Christianity. So if somebody converts to Christianity, they've got a strong case against that. But when they deconvert and they become atheists, that's more challenging in the sense that,
And, you know, to be fair, like a lot of those speakers, Asadullah and Hamza Soetis, and a lot of them consider themselves ex-atheists, right, in a sense. So they consider themselves coming from materialism or like materialistic worldviews or whatever, and they consider themselves experts. in a sense. So that's why, you know, this isn't supposed to be some impartial dialogue. It's not even like those building bridges things they have with Christians, where you have a Muslim and a Christian and they're like, let's build bridges. It's just like deconstructing atheism, you know, like we're gonna like tear this apart, right? And I'm sure they're gonna have some good points and some terrible points. But yeah, I wouldn't expect them to bring an atheist there, because they'll just go against what they're saying, right? So, but yeah, they do have some sort of perspective on atheism, right? Like Hamza Sochis, that's his specialty. Asadullah, that's somewhat his specialty too. And, you know, the Daniel guy as well. So these are the big guns, right? Which you'll notice another thing about all the big guns when it comes to atheism, none of these guys are like sheikhs per se, like, you know, the ones you find in the masjid. These guys are like, you know, a little bit on the younger side, and they've actually like been in the battleground, you know what I'm saying? Like they talk to atheists and stuff. They're not the typical sheikh that you would expect, you know, of Islam. But these are the guys now that are holding up the battle, the losing battle against atheism.
Yes, and of course they don't seem to want to or don't get involved in debates with some of the quote atheist heavyweights, whoever that may be, you know, this Sam Harris, although it's very unlikely they'd ever get to debate him, but somebody like a Matt Dillahunty or whoever it may be. Now, obviously, Matt, for example, is not that knowledgeable on Islam, but he is knowledgeable on the bigger questions, you know, the bigger challenges, so to speak. But yeah, we don't often see that happening either. And on the rare occasions when they do, because I know Tortoise was in a Magic Sandwich show some years back, that didn't go too well, and neither did another IERA guy who debated Aaron Ra. So, yeah, I think when they get involved with sort of the bigger guns, so to speak, the more knowledgeable atheists, which I don't claim to be, I don't know, you guys may feel you're more on that side, but there's definitely much more knowledgeable people out there, and a lot of them are on the internet. So Speaker's Corner is not the place where they're going to come ever. Either they don't live here, they're not going to make the time to do it, or if they do watch one or two videos, they go, this is a waste of time. I mean, my friend Phil, who's an expert in cosmology, has been down there. If you've watched a few of the videos, there's nobody in Speaker's Corner that even remotely comes close to knowing anything about cosmology like he does. But he goes down there so rarely because there's nobody really to debate at his level. Or when they do, they bring up all kinds of fallacies. They can't debate the subject because they don't have any knowledge on it. So that's the other challenge as well. And even when Sorts has debated Krauss on cosmology, of course, he's on no man's land. Now you can talk about the Quran, which Krauss doesn't know, but that doesn't, you know, that doesn't answer the questions that were being asked. So I think there's a big challenge on against, or atheism appears to be a significant challenge to some Muslims.
Yeah, I as a someone that was questioning Islam, I didn't find those debates had any impact on me, like Krauss versus Sortis and like Richard Dawkins versus Mehdi guy. I didn't find those convince me, like the atheist position was very strong, and because they don't know the particulars of Islam and they don't really know the weak points. So they're just speaking in general. But like if it was Matt Dillahunty, like that guy blows me away every time I listen to him. He's just like so sharp, right? And Sam Harris as well, I find he's like very sharp, and he's able to hold his own even against Muslims, right? Like he has a podcast that's like 3 hours long called the Greatest Podcast Ever. I don't know why he got that name. But it's like a long podcast against like a Muslim guy that's like university, like he's some sort of intellectual or something. And Sam Harris, even without knowing Islam, was able to like hold himself up. I was amazed. Like I was like, wow. So yes, you're right. Like if it comes to people like that, like there's no question they'll get demolished. You know, the Muslim position would get completely destroyed. And maybe that's why, you know, me and Abdullah Gondal are having a hard time finding people to debate with. I don't know if you want to jump into that just yet, or you want to continue on this topic a bit more.
No, I think that's a good segue over to sort of the debate, and then we can go on to the surah like it sort of after that. So talk a little bit about debates in whatever way you guys have been invited or been involved in those, and give me your thoughts on debating in general.
So you probably know the story, my history. I wasn't looking for a debate. I wasn't looking to challenge anybody or, you know, start a fight or whatever. I'm just like, you know, putting my position out there online, and, you know, some people are messaging me and they're thankful for it, and it connects with them because they went through the same thing or whatever. But, you know, there was this guy, Ali Dawa, that was online, and he was being kind of aggressive against ex-Muslims. He was shaming, you know, shaming a bunch of them. And so I'm like, okay, like I said, discussing with him on Twitter, and he right away jumped in. He's like, oh, you know, come fly down here and we'll have a discussion with you. And then I said, I can't fly down. He's like, okay, let's have a debate online. And then he eventually, somebody messaged him and told him to back out. So he backed out. And that was my first experience. And the funny thing is, I wasn't even looking forward to it. But once he said he didn't want to do it, then I felt kind of sad. I'm like, oh, I was gonna like have some sort of debate, and it's gonna be fun, right? It was gonna be an interesting kind of thing. I've never done it before. I don't even know what to expect, right? But I thought it was gonna be a good discussion. But he just ran off, right? And then, you know, I had a couple of other people kind of approach me, and one by one, like each one of them backed out. There was this guy who invited me to the mosque in Toronto, and he said the mosque will have it. And I was like, the mosque? You want an atheist in your mosque? Like, weird, but okay, sure. And then he's like, oh, by the way, you can't record it. I was like, what? He's like, yeah, we'll give you a copy after we edit it. You know, actually, he didn't say after he edited, but he's like, yeah, we'll give you a copy later. We'll put it online and you can just mail it. I'm like, no way. You want me to come and talk and you're not going to let me have my own copy? I don't think so. And so that went down the drain. Anyway, so it kept happening over and over again. And more recently, Abdullah Gondal was approached by an individual, and, you know, a self-proclaimed imam, convert, Islamic convert. He calls himself Rewert of 30 years. He's a Muslim for 30 years. He's written a book. He runs a mosque or something. And he's like, I want to debate atheists. I'd love to debate. And he commented on Abdullah Gondal's wall. And Abdullah Gondal tagged me and he's like, what do you think? Like, you want to have a discussion with him? And I'm like, yeah, sure. But I could tell he wasn't interested in discussing with me. So I'm like, okay, you know what? Like, just forget that. Like, how would I host it? And you have a discussion with Abdullah Gondal, because he seemed interested, right? And so then he's like, yeah, cool. Let's talk about Islam. I'm going to talk about my story, how I converted to Islam. I think people would be interested in knowing how a white Texan from, you know, like some white guy from Texas, you know, he was going the approach of like identity politics and, you know, how come a white guy wants to become Muslim? And, you know, and I found this deep spirituality and this benefits and this and that. And, you know, it'd be interesting to see why Abdullah Gondal, you know, he was a Muslim for so many years and he's just left Islam. And, you know, Abdullah Gondal's only been ex-Muslim for less than 1 year. So we're talking about a guy that's been Muslim. He's converted 30 years ago. He's written a book on Islam. And I mean, admittedly, the guy's, I don't know if he knows what he's getting into. He didn't look like he was really prepared for any sort of debate, to be honest. But he wanted to have a discussion. So I told him, you know what, let's not even call it a debate. Let's just call it a discussion. Let's build some bridges. Let's talk about God a little bit. Let's talk about Islam. And you can tell me why you believe. And, you know, and Abdullah will talk about his perspective. And the guy's like, okay, fine. And, you know, I put up an ad on it, on my page. And we had it all set. And we had the time set. And then today, Abdullah Gondal messaged me. Abdullah, you want to tell me what happened?
Yeah. So basically, this guy Kenny Bomber, whose Islamic name is Mujahid al Islam, which means a soldier of Islam that struggles for Islam. He actually studied Islam at Al Mishka University, and is apparently on his bio it says that he's the president of the Brazosport Islamic Society. So. I thought he's an intellectual. He's making YouTube videos. So the picture you showed, Rob, earlier about that atheism conference the Muslims are having, mm-hmm. I made a post about that. And on that post, Kenny comes along and he comments that he wants to debate an atheist. I'm like, you want to debate me? And he's like, okay. So Abdullah makes an event on Facebook and puts it up. Kenny shares it in like five different groups and makes a YouTube video about it. And we're like, okay, it's going to happen. But, and me and Abdullah try really hard to not interact with him till the debate because we didn't want to scare him. Eventually the guy, like last night, makes a video saying exposing the hypocrites Abdullah Samir and Abdullah Gondal. And then on his YouTube, he says that he's not debating us because we mock Islam and we attack Islam. And Allah says in the Quran that do not talk to those who attack or insult the religion or criticize it. So he's like, I'm going to follow what Allah says and I'm just going to reject the debate. And he just backed out, blocked me. And I don't know if he blocked Abdullah Samir, but that's the story. And his biggest thing was that we made a surah, which we called Surah Fa'akaf. And that was, I think that triggered him. And he said, yeah, he's not going to talk to us anymore.
So can I just jump in for a second? That's correct what Abdullah is saying, but it's a little bit different than that. What happened was, he also mentioned that people told him not to have a discussion with us. And I think he was looking for a reason to get out of it, because just like the peer pressure that the admins face in the group, this guy was he mentioned in the video that he had several Muslim brothers contact him and tell him not to do the debate. So, you know, there's people that actually, they could see that, you know, this wasn't going to go well, right? Like, to put it lightly, you know, we were going to be nice. Like, it was just going to be a discussion. Like, I've been saying from the very beginning, like, what's to be scared of? It's just, you're just discussing. Like, there's no need to be so scared, right? You give your perspective to an audience that otherwise you wouldn't have reached, and we get to give our perspective and let the audience decide, right? Like, may the best man win. And it's not even about winning, right? Like, it always ends up in with debates that people think, you know, both sides think, oh, I won, but it's never actually, there's no winner, right? It's just like you present your side and you let people decide what makes sense, right? So I think that he was heavily influenced not to have the debate, which is the same thing that happened with Ali Dawa, the same thing that happened with Ni'matullah, the same thing that happened over, and Abdullah, didn't I tell you this guy might cancel? Like, didn't I say that?
Yeah, Samir, you did that. You had that feeling and you mentioned it quite a few times. One of the funnier things is on his long post about me and Abdullah Samir after canceling the debate. I don't know, Rob, if you've heard of a Muslim convert called John Fontaine. He went on his post and he commented and called me and Abdullah Samir as wild barking dogs.
And this is this Texan Muslim guy, right?
Yeah, this is a big Muslim guy. Yeah. Kenny's
no, he's saying someone went on Kenny's wall and said that. Kenny didn't say that. Kenny was
Sorry.
Yeah, Kenny called us hypocrites. I'm not sure how with hypocrites, but this other guy, John Fontaine, said that, right? Is that correct, Abdullah?
Yes. John Fontaine is a convert and he's actually been hanging out with a lot of big names. If you go to his Facebook, got a lot of followers. And I was so shocked that a guy of his caliber who hangs out with Hamza Sources and makes videos with him. He's the same guy who made the video where the plane was crashing and he pretended to be an atheist. I don't know if you watched that video.
Oh, I haven't seen that one. No, maybe you can give us a link at some point.
Yeah, so that comment, like calling us wild dogs, and I was so shocked. Like, a guy of his caliber and his reputation in the community is using such derogatory remarks. But Kenny, on the other hand, he actually thought that for some reason I'm homosexual.
why is that an insult in the first place?
Like, exactly.
Seriously, guys, grow up. Okay, we're not in high school anymore. Like, grow the hell up. Okay, like I get that all the time too. Ooh, you're gay. Okay, fine, I'm gay. Like, you win. Like, whatever.
So yeah, and then Kenny now has us blocked from his Facebook. So we were interacting with him on his YouTube video, and he still, for some reason, says that I contacted him for a debate when I have screenshots of he was the one who came on my wall and started it.
That to me is very disappointing. I mean, honestly, that really is sad that, like, okay, listen, you don't want to have a debate, don't have the debate, but don't lie. Don't lie about it. And we have, like, you came on Abdullah's page. I took screenshots as well. I posted it saying, like, showing that he's saying, hey, I would love to debate an atheist. And then next thing you know, he's saying, I was approached by Abdullah Samir and Abdullah Gondal to have a debate. But like, why lie about that? Like, what's the point? And then actually, when he got called out on that, that's when he blocked us. So this just thing went just downhill from there. I was also blocked by Ali Dawa. I was also blocked by, it's just like why go to that level? Like why go down to that level of lying and being dishonest and saying something that's not true? And yeah.
Possibly because they've got a lot of followers, and those followers will literally believe whatever they say, and they won't research. And even if evidence came to the contrary, just like your Norman Ali fellow, they can claim that it's a conspiracy against them. It's all made up, so they can come up with some excuse to override it. So perhaps they feel like they can escape anything. They can make any claim they want, and they've got some kind of response that will pacify or be acceptable to the
Absolutely.
followers.
And the other interesting thing is, people are able to agree to debate us before they know who we are. So Kenny really didn't know who Abdullah Gundal was. And it was people that warned him and said, don't debate him. And the same thing happened with me. Ali Dawa had no idea who I was, right? Like, to be honest, I'm a nobody. I'm just some guy that's putting out my opinion, right? And so, but the thing is, what does it say that the people that are like constantly engaged in these type of dialogues are scared to discuss like juniors, like we're not heavyweights. I've been an atheist, like what? I haven't even been an atheist for 2 years. Like when I left Islam, I wasn't even sure about God. I was like, maybe deism is true, right? And so it's not even been 2 years for me. It's not even actually it's been sorry, it's been more than 2 years, almost 3 years. But Abdullah Gundal, not even 1 year. We're talking about like a very short percentage of her life that we've been holding this position. And these guys that are like these guys are scared of discussing with us in public. It's bizarre. Like when if nobody's like us can challenge, Allah's supreme book, the Lord of the universe, the creator of the heavens and the earth, his literal words that he sent to mankind, to his beloved prophet. And losers like me, right, can like say something and like shatter Islam. What does that say about Islam? And it's funny that even the people that are willing to debate us, they don't want to discuss Islam. Like today, we had a discussion. I won't mention the name just in case he changes his mind. I really do hope he changes his mind. But Abdullah initiated a discussion to have somebody else also asked him to have a debate. And this fellow's like, okay, I'll have a debate with you. But you cannot quote any Quran or Hadith. It has to be only rational logic, only logic, no Hadith, no Quran. And I was like, what? Like, what kind of debate, what kind of discussion is that going to be? Like, you want to talk about theism? You're a Muslim. You believe in Allah. You believe in a messenger. You believe in the holy book that was sent. You believe in the prophets. You believe in angels and jinns and all that. But you don't want to debate. You don't want to defend your position. You want to discuss some other position that you don't even believe in, which is some general deism or something. Like, and that's the same issue I had with another fellow who wanted to debate me. Well, I actually went back to him. After Ali Dawa thing fell out, I went to another fellow by the name of Faz, and I said, okay, fine, I'm gonna have a debate with you now because my other debate fell through and now I'm actually interested in doing it. And he's like, okay, I'll have a debate with you only about God. I don't want to talk about Islam. It's like, what the hell is this? Like, everybody wants to talk about God. I said, you want to talk about what? The Kalam cosmological argument, the ontological argument, the like whatever, like the things that nobody ever gets convinced by. Like, oh, the greatest thing that ever existed is possible, that, and then it exists in one universe. It must exist in all universes, and therefore God, therefore Allah, therefore Muhammad, and talk to an angel, and therefore, like, it's just like. It's just like nobody wants to discuss what they believe, and there's a reason for that. Like people, like if somebody's coming to you and they're Muslim and they're saying I'll debate you, but I'm not going to debate Islam, it makes you wonder. Like deep down inside, is it like you must know this is indefensible, right, Abdullah?
Can I ask both of you, do either of you speak Arabic, or can you read the Arabic Quran at all, or is it only the English translations?
Yeah, so 99 probably percent or 99.9% of Muslims can read Arabic, the letters, the sounds, they can read it phonetically. So like the letters, just the sounds that they make, just like any child can do in English, right? They can just read the sounds. They don't necessarily know what the words mean. So that's my level of Arabic understanding. I'm able to read it. I can recite it. And I've memorized a lot of the vocabulary, but I don't know Arabic grammar. So I cannot put together sentences. If I see a verse of the Quran, just from familiarity and just from like memorizing what the words are, I can recognize what's being discussed. But if you give me like an Arabic newspaper or something like that that has a different vocabulary, I wouldn't know what's going on.
Okay. Yes, same thing for me. Like I can read Arabic fluently. I can recite it fluently. Actually, I used to recite at Muslim functions and ceremonies before the ceremony started, or lead prayer. But like the same thing, I'm very familiar with a lot of the Arabic words. So just knowing the meaning of the words, I can get a good grasp of what's being said in the Quran or in the recital, but I can't grab, suppose, a hadith book or an Arabic newspaper and start reading it and understand what it says.
So and then carry on.
One of the other issues I've noticed is like a lot of the Muslims, or actually majority of the Muslims, are non-Arabic speakers. They don't even understand what's being recited. I think only about 20% Muslims are that fully understand classical Arabic and can speak it, right?
Yeah, and even Arabic speakers, may not necessarily, understand the Quran. I had an Arabic Egyptian friend that, he didn't understand the Quran. He had to learn. He knew how to speak Arabic, but he didn't understand the Quranic words. He had to like learn them as well, because it's, I guess the language is a little bit old now, right? And not those words are not necessarily used anymore. People use modern equivalents of words, right? Mm-hmm. Like sayara is like a caravan, right? But in Arabic now it means car, like an automobile. Mm-hmm. So like if you read that in the Quran, it's not talking about cars, right? Like, so you need to know the context of how it was used and stuff like that, right?
What would your two guys' responses be to some Muslims who would suggest, oh, well, if you can't read Arabic fluently or understand it to the level, to a scholarly level, then you are not, how would one say?
Not qualified to deny that it's true?
Not qualified, yep. That potentially as well, yeah. Or to debate, Abdullah, or to
Abdullah,
have a discussion
you,
with people who do understand it well.
Yeah, Abdullah, I'll let you go first on this.
One of the first things you ask them is, hey, do you know Latin or Greek to understand the Bible before you reject the Bible? Like
Greek, yeah.
Yeah, right? Or do you understand Sanskrit before you reject Hinduism? And that's the flaw in this logic, is you don't need to actually understand a specific language fully to decipher what the message is, right? Like suppose nobody has to like learn German and read Hitler's book, I think it's Mein Kampf, before realizing that it's wrong. And what I'm trying to say is it makes it worse for Muslims, because if Allah is the God of all humanity, he shouldn't just pick and choose a certain single language and then make it sound different than others that you can't even understand the message properly from a translation. Like you have to learn a language. That makes it takes away from the idea that God is trying to send a book for all humanity, for everybody to understand, while at the same time you can't even understand it if you don't learn the language.
I think the whole you don't know Arabic is a red herring. It's a way of kind of distracting from the fact that the translation of the Quran is good enough to understand like what it's saying. Like it's, you don't need to have a PhD in Arabic. Like if Allah expected that of people, like I've actually had people tell me, like now that I left Islam, like I'm telling Muslims, tell me, go and study Arabic for 2 years and you'll come back to Islam. And I'm like, are you kidding me? You want me to dedicate another 2 years or 1 year of my life to learn a language just to see if God's message, like really, I need to go through that? Well, what about everybody else? Like, why is that a prerequisite? Like, was that ever the intended purpose that you have to have, you have to be fluent in the language of the holy book that God sent to all of humanity? It doesn't add up, right? And let's be fair. Like the message of the Quran is clear enough in the English translation. There's no God, Muhammad's his messenger, and like To get into like linguistics, if you wanted to say the Quran has like grammar mistakes, or if you want to say the Quran is disjointed and, you know, stuff like that, yes, maybe you need to study the Arabic for that. But if you're going to say that, you know, when Allah says he's putting everybody in hell that doesn't accept Islam, and then you say, well, how is that just? You don't need to know Arabic to deny that. I mean, I don't even need to understand Arabic to know that Allah is using the worst, like, horrific punishments in the Quran. He's describing, like, clothes of fire. Like, I don't need to know how, you know, the word clothes is this word or that word. You know, fire, whether it's a fire that burns forever or this type of fire, that type of fire. I know it's clothes of fire. You know, burning oil they'll be given to drink and pus and this and that. And, like, it's good enough to know that this is what it means, right? It's good enough to understand that the story of Dhulqarnain is a person that, you know, traveled from this place to that place, and he went here and he went there. And then if you want to get into the whole, like, sun setting into the Milky Sea, and, you know, I don't even get into, like, that level of argumentation because I didn't study that. But it's clear enough to say that, hey, this interesting that the exact same story appears in a similar language in a time where, you know, people actually knew about. And it's interesting that the beginning of the story starts with, they ask you about Dhulqarnain. They knew about this legend of Dhulqarnain, right? The people that were asking him. So, I mean, why do I need to know Arabic for that, right? Like, it's just a red herring, right? It's just to distract from the fact that you've actually found problems with the Quran, right? And another red herring that gets thrown at me is, oh, you were Salafi, so you were in the wrong sect. Or some guy's like, oh no, you weren't Salafi enough. I've been told I wasn't Salafi enough, and I've been told because I didn't know the names of like enough scholars of Salafism or something, or Wahhabism. And the other guy is telling me, oh, you're Salafi, you were never Muslim. I'm like, are you telling me all Salafis are not Muslim? No, I'm not saying that. And then at that point, I just say, you know, thank God I'm not part of this infighting anymore. Oh, this guy is wrong, and this guy is misguided, and this guy's Kafir, and that guy's Kafir. I'm like, listen, I'm just thankful I'm not part of this mess anymore. This mess of a religion that was left to you from a God that didn't even, you know, think about like preserving his book before the death of his prophet, and people after he died had to think about putting it into a book. That God needs a little bit better planning skills, because you know what? He just left a mess of a religion. So yeah, I think it's a red herring, the whole language issue.
Yes, and I've just made a note here as you were talking about it, that it seems to be a double standard. So if those people claim that you've got to understand Arabic, then surely the same standard should apply for those who are converting to Islam. Muslims should actively say, no, hang on a moment, you should not convert. Please learn Arabic first. Then if you still feel like you need to convert, then convert. But you can't ask to learn Arabic and not the new convertees. It's, the double standards are, you know, this is the biggest problem I have, and maybe from here we can go on to the surah like it. But the biggest problem I have is the tactics and the dishonesty, the fallacies. I watch a lot of these videos and I'm quite familiar with them now. And I focus on the tactics that each of these speakers does, because they say the same thing. So after you've heard it once or twice, they keep saying the same thing. And so now it's a case of just zoning in on the tactics they use. And I think that's the thing. I find it really challenging, and I really do find it difficult to honestly find that I've spoken to, you know, a handful of honest Muslims, especially when new people there. Obviously that's different. I don't know them, and I always take everybody as being an honest person the first time I meet them. It's over a period of time where I notice things where they've said certain things, and then, you know, they've been shown that it's wrong, and they keep doing the same thing and so forth. And for me, that's the huge problem. And again, maybe it's just the sect of Sunni Muslims that I had Speaker's Corner, because when I see the Shias come down there, at least I think you can have a more honest conversation. We could still disagree on just about everything, but I think you could probably still have that conversation, and they would go, I don't know. Or that it seems to me, and I could be wrong, but it seems to me that they would genuinely not try to invoke tactics there. But tactics just seems to be a big thing. I've got to look good on camera or look good in a debate or whatever. And the fear, and both of you guys talked about it, which is the fear of not looking good or not seeing as if you have an answer. And that for them seems to be the biggest thing. So they've all seemed to have evolved certain ways of dealing with this, either not answering questions, shouting, talking nonstop, whatever the tactic is, to not be able to do it. And on the rare occasions when they do sort of come across as not knowing something and just not being honest enough to say, hey, I don't know, then something else happens that they can divert away from.
And here's an interesting question. If I say the Quran allows slavery, and somebody says to me, oh, you don't know Arabic, then I would ask them, do you know Arabic? And if they say yes, Then I would ask them, what does the Quran say? Like, so the funny thing is usually the people that, say this to you, you don't know Fusha, you don't know classical Arabic. They themselves don't know it. So how do they know it's not saying that? It's the same problem they're accusing us of. You don't know what it means. Well, then neither do you. And then nobody knows what it means. And that's not, the Quran says it's Quran Mubin, right? It's Mubin, it's clear, right? So that contradicts the Quran being Mubin.
All right, let's move on. Gondal, maybe you can share with us a little bit about the surah like it, that little interesting, tell everybody about it so people are aware of what transpired there.
So basically, one of the challenges Allah brings forth in the Quran is, he says that the eloquence and the beauty of the Quran is so superior and the content is so beautiful that no human can ever produce one chapter like it. Now, the issue is the smallest chapter in the Quran is only three verses. And we were like, this is an absurd challenge, because when we look at some of the content of the smallest chapters, there's this one chapter called Surah Lahab, and it's basically Muhammad had an uncle who disagreed with him and he swore at Muhammad. So
can you read it in Arabic first?
Yeah, it's Tabbat yada Abi Lahabin watab. ما أغنى عنه ماله وما كسب سيصلى نارا ذات لهب وامرأته حمالة الحطب في جيدها حبل من مسد.
Everybody's memorized this surah.
Yeah. And this surah is basically, the content is that Muhammad got sworn at. So Allah sent an angel, Gabriel, with this revelation in his last and final ever message to humanity. And all the message is Muhammad, he called you this, no, he's going to burn in hell. No, he's that, he's this. And it's like Allah is in a yelling match with him and her, saying his wife and him saying that they're just going to torture.
It's epic laugh battle. Yo, you insulted my prophet. You are the one you're going to be cursed. You're going to go to hell. And your wife too, she's going to be carrying this thing around her neck. Yeah, sorry. I got carried away.
So I was like, this is pretty easy to match, right? So we found this surah that was written by, I'm not going to name the person due to security issues, because it was written by a person who has a degree in Arabic literature from the University of London, I believe. He's a very, very big name in the Muslim community. He has written books for Muslim kids as well. He's now an apostate. So he's a good command over Arabic. And he wrote this surah. It's called Surah Faqaf. Or he named it a Surah the Judge.
Yeah. The Surah of the Chicken. Yeah.
So we had somebody recite the Surah. We edited it out, made it look like the Quran. And our social experiment was that
we didn't even really make it look like the Quran. We just put the words in a video that were being read. And we read, and it was being read in a nice voice, right? Like kind of like how you'd read the Quran, right? Like not the way you just read Surah Lahab, but like in a sing-songy voice, like Yasin, Walqur, like reading it with like, you know, in a nice melodious voice, right?
Yeah. So basically, when you look at the content of the surah we made, it starts with mysterious letters, like a lot of the chapters in the Quran. Then it goes on soaring by creations of Allah, which a lot of the Quranic chapters do. Then the surah goes on to tell about some sins that you shouldn't commit, and if you do that, you'll go to hell, just like the Quran does. Then it's as the Quran jumps from topic to topic and it lacks a lot of structure, the surah just suddenly jumps to talking about the day of judgment, and you know, people who are good will get this and that, and people who are bad will get this and that. And in the end, the surah mentions that for people who are good, they'll get rivers of water and gardens, and then it says they'll get crates of whiskey and dancing girls with no veil, which is funny because it's exactly what Allah wants. It says rivers of wine and women in tents that nobody's ever touched, right? It's the content is very similar to the Quran. The rhythm it uses, the rhythm of and R, which is found in, suppose, Surah Taha or Surah Maryam. It sounds almost exactly like the Quran, to the point when Muslims first, when we uploaded the video, Muslims got tricked thinking that Abdullah's account has either been hacked or he's reverted back to Islam, or that
we had Yeah, we posted the video, and not being like bigots, sometimes I post things positive about Islam, right? And because I give credit where credit is due, and I've posted things before, like this is cool and whatever. And I made the post, and I said this is a beautiful surah. I said this is a beautiful recitation, and it's emotional and it's true. Like it actually brings back a lot of nostalgia when you listen to it. You're like, wow, it almost reminds you of this spiritual feeling you felt, this connection with Allah. And I had a bunch of people. One of them was a Hafiz. He's ex-Muslim now, and he was like, he told me it's beautiful, right? And then he told me, I don't like. He's like, I don't remember this. Like, I'm like, did you watch it to the end? And he's like, no. I said, okay, go back and watch it to the end, because then after that, he's like, oh, I get it. It's not Quran, right? But it sounds like a bunch of like. I think almost everybody had the same reaction. They immediately just thought it was Quran. No, I mean, I think the dead giveaway to some people were like, why is Abdullah posting this? Like, why would he post Quran, right? I think I might have even posted Quran before, I don't know. But so a lot of people were like, people that were friends with us were just like, okay, this Quran's beautiful, right? I mean, it's kind of nice or whatever. People that were not necessarily friends with us were like suspicious, and they were like, right away, the first reaction was like, you guys are. You nasty people, you're mocking the religion, you're mocking, and nobody's ever gonna wanna engage with you after this. How dare you insult us? This is vulgar, this is disgusting. Funny thing, this is like one guy had this kind of overreaction in the group, right? He's like, I'm gonna get this video taken down, I'm gonna get it removed. This is offensive to me, and I'm so upset, and you're mocking and this and that. And the funny thing is, we actually made the video, you can say, in obedience to Allah. Allah says, say to them, try and make a surah like it, and you will not be able to, even if everyone helps you. So, what's so blasphemous about responding to the challenge of what Allah said? I can't even take credit for the fact that I didn't even write the surah. Pretty much all I did was I did video editing. Okay, like that's it. I can't even take credit for this. But people got so mad, and a lot of people got hung up over the fact that we called it Surah Fa-Qaf. I didn't want to put Surah Dajjaj, because Dajjaj is the word for chicken, is not in the Quran. There's no chicken mentioned in the Quran. There's cows and other stuff. I don't know if there was chickens in Arabia. I don't know why Dajjaj is not mentioned in the Quran. Anyways, beside the point, I didn't want to give it. We didn't want to give it away, so we called it Surah Fa-Qaf. There's Surah Taha. There's like different surahs like that, right? So. It was it was an interesting kind of experiment to see whether people would figure out this is actually not Allah's word, and can you tell the difference, right? So I'm really hoping that someone does a social experiment and like play, because there's videos on YouTube called, Lady Hears Quran for the First Time, right? And then, I don't know if they start crying or they have some sort of reaction, right? And they say, this is so beautiful, like this can't be from a man. This must be from God. Like, and of course, these people never become Muslim, but they say these beautiful things, right? So it would be really cool for someone to do like a social experiment with Surah Fa-Qaf and to see like how Muslims react, right? I mean, we already know. We've seen like nobody even got the point until we told them, watch the whole video, because it's only at the very end that it says, by the way, this is not the Quran, this is a surah like it. But people want to take it their own way, they want to think we're mocking. I had no intention of mocking. The whole point of this thing was to make people think, is there anything really special about the Quran? And obviously the answer is no. It's just, and then we had some people say, oh, but you use the same words that's in the Quran. Yes, it's in Arabic, in the Arabic language. And if I use modern words, you say no, it doesn't qualify because it's not using the classical Arabic. Like you can't win, because the challenge is so subjective. I'm always nervous to say it, but like Muhammad was being a troll, right? When he said, oh, you can't write a book like it, because it's an ill-defined challenge. There's no way to meet the challenge, because there's no objective criteria, right? It's just like being a troll, right? It's just like making a challenge that nobody can ever meet, right? And say, aha, you can't meet the challenge, because no matter what you come up with, everyone will say like, oh, nope, that's not good enough. That's not Arabic enough, or it's not in Arabic. So and I think we can do a full video on, why the challenge of the Quran is a terrible challenge. But I mean, that's a different topic altogether. The point of this video was just to make people kind of like think like, and you know, this isn't even the first response to the Quran. There's been a bunch of them that people have done already. I think Uz was the first one that was recited so beautifully like that. There's a Surah Atheism someone uploaded, but it's not as good as this one in my opinion. But yeah, it has, and that one has its own like Arabic structure and grammar and language that you know has that someone that knows Arabic really well has wrote it as well. So obviously there's been multiple responses to the Quran already, right? But somehow Muslims tend to kind of have a fit, some of them, when you actually implement. Not all of them, some of them are, you know, like, yeah, this is kind of interesting. I think you did a terrible job and I don't think you actually achieved the challenge. And that's what we wanted to hear. Okay, fine, we didn't.
You've highlighted a good point there, which is I agree with you. Even when I first heard this and I asked the questions, well, who decides this? What is the criteria? And then they said, oh, there's 42, 43 different sort of, what do you call them, linguistic things that you can look for, etc. Well, who's going to judge this? And surely not every verse has got this. So it's really unfalsifiable. And then when you do the challenge, of course, they've got to say, it's not one, even if it sounded great, even if they got fooled. Oh, I got fooled, but I don't understand Arabic or whatever. This is the problem I have. These sort of supposed challenges that get trotted out as if it's a real challenge is unfalsifiable. Its criteria, like you say, are completely subjective. Who's going to make the judgment? Those Muslims that would judge it are always going to judge it as not being authentic. So, you know, please don't waste our time making the supposed challenge, because once it's been shown that this is not the case, you are just being dishonest. Kondal, have you got anything you want to add on the surah like it? Otherwise, I've got a few questions in the chat, and we'll sort of start to wrap it up by 12. And I've also got TJ, who's been very quiet and silent there. So, Kondal, maybe just any sort of last words on the surah like it, and then maybe TJ, if you want to ask any questions, go ahead.
Okay, so basically, one of the other responses I got to the surah like it was this one guy claimed that, oh, you can just sing anything in Arabic and make it sound melodious. And he went to the extent of actually making a YouTube video. He grabbed a random news article and then tried reciting it like the way we did. And the funny thing was, it sounds nothing like the surah we made. And yet he's boasting that it's just a random news article, a random poem. And anyways, I said, you know, I dare you to upload the video, put it side by side to the recitation we had and the content of our surah. With you reading a newspaper article, we'll see, but people be the judge. Obviously, he's never going to do that.
And he didn't actually upload the video publicly. It was unlisted, right? He made it just to post as a response on your page, right? He didn't even want to like publicly say that this is wrong, right?
Yeah, it was very embarrassing. Anyways, one of the repercussions from this surah, just before we move away, was after that Hyde Park group that we got kicked out of, there was a second group made again with atheist moderators in there. It was called Hyde Park Prime Group, right? So we posted this surah in there and we didn't say anything. We said, this is amazing recitation, watch till the end. And it was just as I posted it on my wall. Nobody was being attacked or anything. We got the post got removed. Not only everybody got booted out of the group, the whole group got shut down. This is how, and this was apparently a group that cherishes free speech. So it's clearly not free speech if you're restricting it. Anyways, that happened. One other thing Abdullah forgot, Samir got to mention, is when the initial incidents were happening with the Hyde Park group, he got added into the group again and then literally kicked out a minute later.
Yeah, someone added me back for a second. I'm like, oh, they put me back. That's cool. And then 5 seconds later, like, there's multiple admins, right? So
yeah.
I think they were having a debate, internal conflict there or something. Yeah.
Yes, I think one admin doesn't know what the other one's doing, or if they do, they don't care, and one just does whatever they wants. Agree.
Yeah.
The other funny thing was the reciter, right? He's obviously not a native speaker of Arabic in the Surah Like It challenge. So he did get some pronunciation of certain words wrong, which is fine because the same reciter, when he used to recite at Muslim events and would lead prayer in the mosque and give sermons, that same recitation was being praised by Muslims and it was like a big thing. He was a poster boy for Quranic recitations, right? But as soon as it's against the Quran, it's the other way around and they kind of become like oh, your recitation is so bad. You make so many mistakes. I'm like, what happened all of a sudden? You loved mine before.
And we knew that there was problems with the recitation, not problems, but minor issues. It just wasn't really worth the time to like do it again. And, you know, like we understood there's going to be some minor issues with like the pronunciation of dajaj versus dajaj, you know, whatever, right? Mistakes. But the point wasn't about reciting it perfectly. The point was about just showing how similar it sounded. And that's it. Like, people can take what they want from it. You know what I mean? Like,
well, that's the whole point. If there's a challenge and you are then going to go and attempt to meet it, then that's the point, supposedly the point of the challenge, which obviously we think is unfalsifiable. TJ, yes, have you got anything you want to add? And then I'm going to ask a few questions from the chat, and I think we'll wrap it up from there.
Thanks, guys. I just had a couple of questions. First, in terms of regarding of the term, you know, jihad, when you guys were Muslim before, how did you view it? And have your views changed about the concept of jihad?
So I think this is a kind of longer topic. And because we're kind of near the end of the video, I'd rather just pass on that. But what I will say is I have a video on my channel, youtube.com/AbdullahAdam. I have a video, Islam, Jihad, and Terrorism, where I pull my heart out and I explain what I used to believe as a Muslim and what I believe now. But basically, like, the whole concept of jihad from a kind of Sunni perspective. So I don't want to be rude, but just because it's a little bit of a longer topic, and I just to say that the answer is out there, it's just, I think it'll take too much time to kind of get into that now.
I can answer that briefly. It's basically, when I was a Muslim, I was constantly taught that the word jihad just means strive and struggle. And strive and struggle is within the inner self. And basically the biggest jihad is to strive in the way of Allah to do more good deeds and stuff. But when you look at the context of how the word was used in the Quran and the Hadith, it becomes apparently clear that the word mostly referred to physical warfare. Like Muhammad, in the 10 years he was in Medina, he took part in about 27 wars himself and dispatched around a total of 60. So there was basically a war a month. And verses that classically talk about jihad, if you look at the tafsirs, they mostly mention that the jihad in the Quran refers to physical warfare and struggling against the non-believers. But that's just to summarize, it's a long discussion.
Now I have to say something. Okay, it's the opposite for me. Like, I was taught and I believe that jihad does have a meaning of inner struggle as well. But I used to listen to like Anwar Awlaki, and I used to read the book of Hadith myself about jihad and the Quran. And I give all the references in my video. But basically, I believe that jihad was physical jihad. And I used to believe that not to get into a pointed topic, but the people in Palestine, they were doing jihad. I believe there was such a thing as illegitimate jihad and legitimate jihad. But I felt that anyone that was being attacked in the homes or whatever, and they fought back, and they killed for the sake of Allah, and any Islamic state that wanted to expand its empire, you know, could do jihad. And if you died in that battle, you would actually go to paradise. So I used to believe in it. It was a physical jihad, and the inner jihad I was taught was much less than the physical jihad. It was an inner struggle, but it was much, and it says in the Quran itself, not equal are those that go and fight and those that stay behind, right? The people that stay behind, they're at a lesser rank than the people that went out and they fought, right? And this is like really clear in the Hadith. So I had the exact opposite interpretation and understanding. I was taught jihad means to fight and to die for the sake of Allah. And I even wanted to go for jihad, you know, but I didn't know where to go and how to go and how to do that. And I didn't believe jihad was basically bombing innocent people. Like, in, let's say, in Canada, innocent means anyone that's like here basically is innocent person, right? But I did believe that it would have been okay for me to go and fight in a Muslim army against the disbelievers that were, you know, whatever. Basically, that's a long story short. So it's the opposite of what Abdullah.
My last question would be, you know, like you guys, you know, I'm also Desi, you know, I come from a Punjabi background. And I was curious to know, within your experiences within the, like, you know, Desi Muslim community, do they believe that they're actually descendants of Arabs and people from, like, you know, Central Asia, or do they believe that they are basically, you know, Islamized Hindus?
From what I have understood so far, because I'm a Desi too with Pakistani origins and mostly lived my whole life there, they're actually very proud people. They have their own separate culture from Arabic culture, their own food. They take pride in their culture. Most of, like, suppose in Pakistan, most Muslims still listen to music, although Islam, generally Sunni Islam, prohibits it. I don't think anybody says they're descendants of Arabs, but they just, they're basically mostly Islamized.
Well, there's a whole Sayyid thing, right, Abdul? Mm-hmm. Abdullah? There's a whole Sayyid, oh, this guy is Sayyid, and this guy is Sayyid, oh, yeah. And mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that part is funny. It's some of them say that they're direct descendants of the family of Muhammad, but that's a small group, and they refer to themselves as Sayyid. And they claim that Muslims cannot give charity to the family of Muhammad, so they wouldn't accept charity or anything like that, even to this age and day. It's been 1400 years something, and they still think they're actually part of Muhammad's family.
It's funny because, they actually did the DNA testing, and they said that, you know, Indians and Pakistanis all share the same, you know, DNA. So I found that kind of funny when some of them will come up and say, yeah, like, you know, I'm an Arab and this and that, when, like, you know, the DNA says otherwise. So that was kind of interesting. Thank you.
Cool. Thanks, DJ. Just a couple of quick questions to finish off. Hopefully we can be brief on them. The question in the chat from a Muslim was, when you talked about the Quran, let me just see if I can find it here. I lost it. I thought I had it here. He said there was a context behind it. Do you know the context? So I just want to see if I can actually, I'm now trying to scroll through it here. When you're looking for something, you can't find it. It's amazing. I'm literally trying to find that comment. Marshall, if you made that comment about the Quran and the context, do you want to just type it in again quickly? I seem to have lost the comment that you had there originally. So quickly type that in if you still want me to ask it. Or any other comments? I seem to have lost them all in the chat here now. So, here we go. Here's one. Sorry, there's the two comments. I might find it. Here we go. Abdullah, I'm not sure which one, obviously. I'm speaking to one of the two of you. When Allah said the Quran is clear, what's the context behind it? So I guess this is in reference to the Quran being clear for all men,
Mubin?
For all people to understand. Either one of you or both of you.
It's Mubin. I would take that to mean that it's, you know, it's clear. Like, the central message of Tawheed, of the unity of God, of being thankful, of obedience, blind obedience to, you know, the messenger, about not questioning, you know, I would say that is clear. I don't know if there's more to it than that. Maybe I missed something. That's how I take it. Clear means clear.
Yeah, I would suspect it's clearly understood by people. I think when we were talking about the Quran being clearly understood by people.
And I used to study the tafsir and the history and the sila, the Quran came to people that were, you know, mainly illiterate. These are not like intellectual aristocrats, you know, sipping the tea and saying, oh, you know, let's talk about Greek philosophy and Aristotle said this. These are people that were like peeing in the mosque, some of them. These are people that would like kill someone if they found him with the wife, you know, they just like chop off his head, right? Not to demean them in any way, but this was a harsh desert life, and there were city dwellers that were more eloquent. The majority of the Muslims, they were accused of being sufaha, of being the poor people, of being the scum, right? And so the Quran came in a time and place where the majority of people, you know, one of the companions, one man came to the Prophet and said, okay, like, what if I want to be Muslim? And all I want, and I just want to pray and do nothing else. Like, that's all I want to do. I just want to pray. I'm just going to do one thing only. Just pray. The Prophet said, okay, you'll go to paradise, right? The guy was like, cool. That's all I need to know. That's fine. Okay. So like, there's obviously different people, and the Quran was supposed to appeal to different people at different levels. But the main message was simple enough for the common person to hear and to understand what it was saying, that there's a day of judgment, that there's a reckoning, that you're going to be judged and you have to obey Muhammad, right? And whatever Muhammad says comes from Allah, right? So That's what Quran means, Mubin. I mean, it wasn't meant to be an intellectual exercise. And yes, maybe there's multiple levels of understanding where there's like a surface level, like kind of message, and then there's a deeper message behind it. Sure, you can argue that, but I would also argue that the simple message is obviously there's no point going to a deeper message, right?
Yeah. Okay, good. You just cut up at the end there, but I think we got the main gist of it. Gondal, I want to ask you the second question on here, because I think after this we will wrap up. Somebody else asked here, do the Abdullahs consider the concept of abrogation as a part of the Surah Laiki challenge, as Allah will bring something better or similar? So Allah is competing with himself?
No, it's a totally different concept. The idea is of abrogation, like it's called nasakh and mansukh. It's a totally different idea. It's basically Allah sends a revelation, then finds it inadequate or wants to replace it with something better, looking at the situation. So he abrogates or makes you forget some of the verses and gives a better one in its place. So it's not comparable to the Surah Laika challenge. The Surah Laika challenge is somebody external to the Quran who's not a Muslim should bring something like it. For example, I'll give you what abrogation might look like. A beautiful example would be verse 495. In Bukhari, there's quite a few hadith where Muhammad is sitting and he says he just received a revelation. So he asked one of his buddies to bring ink and a piece of paper and pen, a piece of camel bone to write the verse on. He writes the verse and then there's this blind man sitting behind Muhammad who's like, the verse says that people who fight in the way of Allah are not equal to the ones who stay at home. And then he says, what about me? I'm blind. I can't fight. So Muhammad's like, oh, never mind. Allah just changed his mind. And now he told me that, yeah, include the part except those who are not able to. Right? This is one concept of abrogation, or suppose the verse of stoning. Right? Stoning is not found in the Quran right now. No verses. It used to be in Surah Ahzab. But for some reason, the verses got abrogated. That is, they got canceled and they're not found anymore. But there's hadith in the Bukhari and Muslim and all the other Sahih Sitta that clearly say that Allah revealed these verses as part of the Quran and they got abrogated. So Surah Laika and abrogation are two different concepts.
Yeah, and not everybody agrees with the whole abrogation. There's a lot of debate in the Muslim community exactly what abrogation means, and it's a very in-depth topic. I don't think we can just cover the whole thing right now.
No, that's fine. I do want to thank you guys. If you're available again, we could do it on a particular topic, such as the couple that you mentioned, which are probably too long for a short chat, but we could have a longer chat. So I'll be in contact with you again and see if we can do something like that again. I do obviously want to thank you guys tremendously for coming on. It's 12 o'clock at night here in the UK, so I think it's a bit of bedtime for me. I've got early work tomorrow. But please share a few closing thoughts, each of you. And then we'll wrap it up.
Okay, so I'll go first. I just want to leave a thought experiment before we wrap it up to whoever's listening, and if there's any Muslims listening. So imagine this. I come up to you and I tell you that there's an invisible guy in the sky called Xenu. He's the real God. He has an invisible army of mini robots that emit light. You can't see them. They're all around us watching us. Then he has this bad guy called Zion who misleads people. And he has a small army of his minions called the Titans that infect human souls, basically mini devils. He's got this imaginary place called the oven where he tortures and burns people who disobey him. And this beautiful place called the garden where he rewards the believers. All of these ideas and claims cannot be verified, proven, tested. Basically, they're unfalsifiable claims. They have no evidence to support them. If you don't believe in these ideas, then you will be burned forever in the torture lair called the oven. This sounds absurd to anybody. But the problem is, this is exactly what theism is. It's trying to sell you an invisible product, and this is how Islam appears to somebody who's not been indoctrinated by it. It's exactly the same as the Xenu story I told you. Just change the Xenu to Allah, Zion to Shaitan, heaven and hell, Jannah, Jahannam, angels and demons. And that's what I'm trying to get to. Hopefully it helps people understand the absurdity in believing things without evidence, and especially having blind faith.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. I think Samir has dropped off for some reason. I'm not sure if he's going to come back. We'll give it a minute to see if he's going to come back. Do you have any quick thoughts here, TJ? Oh, there he is. Hang on a moment. Let me just add him back in again.
Yeah.
There we go. Okay. Never mind, TJ. Hold that thought. I thought you dropped off there. We're going to check if you're going to come back. Samir, thanks so much. Do you want to give a few closing thoughts and then we'll call it a day?
No, I think Abdullah said it well, and I'll leave it at that.
All right, brilliant. Guys, I want to thank you very much for coming onto the show. Again, we'll look to do this again in the future at some point. If you want, we can do certain topics. I have invited the admin, unfortunately, couldn't make it. I do invite Muslims. Again, if you know any Muslims, please invite them onto the show. You could come on. I'm happy to host if you wanted to have a conversation with a Muslim. Also, I'd love to get this Texan Muslim's details, if we can get hold of that and come onto the show if he's willing. But until Friday this week, I want to say goodnight to everybody. Thanks so much to both Abdullahs, to TJ, to everybody who's watched. And we'll see you again Friday and hopefully every Friday thereafter. Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.